are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of February 21st, 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor for Technical Content at Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. We've got a great panel, and it's been an interesting week for IT, so let's plan to hop right into it. First, let me introduce my panel to begin with. Over on the virtual left, we have Dave Wagner, Executive Editor for Community here at Information Week. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
And to the virtual right, we have Kelly Sheridan, who is Associate Editor and soon to be International Correspondent for Information Week. Kelly, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure to have both of you on the show, and let's dive in. Dave, I'm going to turn to you first and ask, was there anything this week that truly caught your eye as being a standout top story?
Well, I think there are two that are tied and related. I think one is the ongoing Apple saga that we touched on a little bit last week, although I'm sure we'll be talking about again. And then, of course, Mobile World Congress. So in a lot of ways, we're all about the mobile this week.
I agree, and we're going to talk about both of those. Kelly, going to turn to you. What have you seen this week that stood out for you?
This one, I was going to say both of those things, but we saw some really interesting coming out of Mobile World Congress. And it was a really interesting week to watch the Apple FBI debate. So I'm excited to talk more about that later.
I'm going to agree with both of you on both of those two really big stories. And to keep us from all just agreeing on those two, I think it's fascinating. One of the stories that Google Fiber is finally rolling out in, of all places, San Francisco, and they're doing something interesting. They're piggybacking on top of existing infrastructure. So that provides some insight into what might happen in the future. But before we talk about Google, let's dive into these other stories. And because I think that the Apple story could take a while, let's look at Mobile World Congress first. Now, for those of you who don't know, Mobile World Congress is an annual meeting in Barcelona, Spain, and it really is where the world's mobile phone providers, mobile phone hardware vendors, and mobile phone application vendors all get together to show off what's going to be really huge in mobile for the coming year. It is a very, very big deal. It's a huge show and truly global. And it seems to me that this year we've already got a couple of stories that are starting to come out of it. Now, Dave, you were the first person to mention Mobile World Congress. So what have you been hearing about that you think is going to be a big story coming out of Mobile World Congress?
Well, I think it depends on your perspective, because one way you can look at Mobile World Congress is you can kind of yawn and say there wasn't any major phone upgrade or mobile upgrade. Most of those major product announcements were iterative, like the Galaxy 7 Edge, or we're still seeing a lot of convertibles and transformational laptops and tablets. On the other hand, what I thought was kind of exciting about this year is that the fact that we may have reached maturity in the mobile phone meant that there was room for some other interesting things. And the two that came out for me were virtual reality. We saw quite a lot of new virtual reality entrants. LG, I thought, put out a pretty nice one. And then the other is LG, again, not to give too much credit to them, came out with a sort of modular phone design. line specifically built around accessories. And I think that that is an indication of where we are in the phone market, that we're going to start looking at hardware accessories as a way of maintaining profitability and differentiation in phones. LG's solution, I don't think, is necessarily the most elegant solution I've seen, but essentially the bottom part of the phone slides out, and things like a better camera can be, or a VR device can be put, can be attached to the phone and used for things. I'm not sure that's the final iteration, but it is an impressive innovation considering what we saw basically from all the other major phone companies, which is a phone that looked an awful lot like the phone they had last year.
All right, to some big stuff there. We'll want to go into that a little bit. But, Kelly, how about you? What have you seen that, that really strikes your interest as being something important at Mobile World Congress?
You know, I thought it was interesting that Dave brought up the importance of accessories, because one of the devices that I had a eye on this week was the HP Elite X3. It's a Windows 10 mobile phone, which is interesting in itself that HP is going with that platform, but it's really marketing the accessories to, the idea is that this phone will be your only business device. So Windows 10 Mobile has this feature called Continuum, where you can project your phone onto a larger monitor. So along with the smartphone, HP is marketing this device called the Desk Dock. And you plug your phone onto the desk dock alongside your monitor, and all of a sudden, whatever is on your phone is on your bigger desktop monitor. And the idea is that you can kind of carry your PC around with you. And then another accessory that they're marketing is the mobile extender, which is basically like a laptop shell almost. The laptop shell has really little functionality of its own, but it's powered by the smartphone. So they're not just selling a smartphone. It's like they're selling an entire ecosystem.
Well, the ecosystem is quite important, and I agree. The accessories in an ecosystem are critical. I mean, if nothing else, Apple has shown us the importance of an ecosystem when it comes to mobile devices. But I'm going to say the one that I thought was interesting leading up to Mobile World Congress is the world's first, it's called, being called a $4 smartphone. And for me, the importance here is that so much of the world's population is still using what is now referred to as a feature phone. That's the kind of phone that all of us here in North America used to carry, the flip phone, or the one where you had to hit each key four times if you wanted to go around texting people. But the majority of the world is still on the feature phone. And I'm intrigued by the possibilities that could come about if more of the world had a smartphone, especially in the places where people are using the phone as their primary way of doing banking, for example, or interacting with their government. But let's circle back around. Dave, you and Kelly both talked about this notion of the modular system or the ecosystem and why accessories are important. Why do you think that we're seeing this very keen interest in accessories this year?
Well, I think for the same reason why we're seeing explosions in 4K TVs or smart TVs or refrigerators that can talk, I think the we've reached the point where people who aren't using $4 smartphones, people who are using smartphones in developed countries, they were for quite a while on a 2-year throwaway cycle. It was basically built into your contract with your provider that every 2 years you'd throw your old phone away and they'd give you a new one because the pace of the technology was changing that fast. I have now on almost my third year of my current phone. I'm about to upgrade. I suspect that the next phone I buy is probably going to go more like 4 or 5. We're starting to see a slowdown in the disposability of smartphones. And so if your sales are going to slow down simply by the fact that the replacement cycle is increasing, you need to find a way to make up for the lost revenue.
I think that that's really interesting. And, you know, that slowdown in the cycle is something that seems to have had a huge impact on the tablet market. And I suppose
Definitely.
It might be inevitable that as smartphones grow closer to tablets in both size and functionality, that we'd see the refresh cycles merging a bit. Now, Kelly, I'm going to turn to you. Is this something that you have noticed in your purchasing and in the purchasing of the people around you? You're in a different large city than Dave, in a much different place than where I live. Is this something that you have noticed in those around you?
It is, and kind of going off of that as well, I think there's something to be said about the lack of innovation in smartphones. You know, so many people are still using feature phones, and the average people, I found out the other day, I think it's something like half of people who use an iPhone are using like an iPhone 5 or lower. I think we get to a point where the iPhone does everything you need, or like the smartphone you have does everything you need, and then some. I think that people are motivated less to upgrade to the iPhone 7 or what have you, because there really isn't just that much to compel them. So kind of going back to what Dave said, I think that companies are looking to accessories and other products to just kind of garner that excitement again, because I think smartphones have kind of like, you know, hit their plateau.
Right. And there's another half of this, actually, which is the Internet of Things, right? You've got most consumer-oriented Internet of Things products work through a tablet or a phone. One way or the other, you're controlling, whether you're controlling your thermostat, your lights, your alarm system, whatever it is, you're mostly controlling it through the central reality of your phone or your tablet. And when that is so, it means the phone becomes not just a communication, an internet device, a gaming device. It becomes a indispensable part of your lifestyle, right? I think all of us experienced probably 5 to 10 years ago, depending on when we got on the smartphone bandwagon, that there are two items you have to leave your house with, your keys and your phone. You don't even have to leave with your wallet anymore, but you better have your keys and your phone. And so because the phone is the device that no one wants to be without, there it's always within reach. It's the perfect accessory for any new product that's coming out in the consumer space, even if you wouldn't necessarily associate it with firsthand. It makes perfect sense to make sure it's connected to now.
You're absolutely right about the connectivity, and it's interesting that you talk about skipping generations. I know I went straight from an iPhone 4 to a 6 Plus. I skipped the 5s entirely, and I think you're right. More and more people are doing that because the phones, and this is true whether you are in the Apple ecosystem or one of the variety of Android phones, they're all pretty darn good. We've gotten to the point where we're quibbling over whether 12 megapixels is a good enough camera to have in your phone. They're all, as communication devices, pretty darn good. And with the size screen that something like the 6 Plus has, it's a great interface for just about anything you want to do in terms of embedded control. Kelly, is controlling other devices something that you do a lot, or that you have heard about people doing in your coverage a great deal?
Personally, no, but hearing other people do it, yes. You know, I think going forward, I've heard you'll be able to use your phone to control your garage, your lights, the heat in your home. My father uses his phone to control a thermostat. Like, it just becomes so essential to you that it makes sense for companies to innovate around, you know, different products that will relate to that.
Well, we're talking about doing more and more with the phones. And I think this is kind of an interesting place to segue into the other big story that we've been talking about. And that is the ongoing battle between Apple and the FBI. I can't imagine that any of our listeners are not aware of this story in which the FBI wants Apple to provide software that will let them break into the iPhone that was used by the perpetrators in the shootings out in San Bernardino recently. Kelly, first to you, is this a story that you have been following? And, you know, what is your take on the story as it sits today?
I actually really like watching it. I think it's fascinating to watch it unfold. I'm siding with Apple on this one. I think that creating a version of iOS that would allow the FBI to access the information that it's demanding is, like many have said, it's a dangerous step. You know, once a system like that is created, it can't be uncreated. You know, it exists, and there's always the potential that it'll fall into the wrong hands. So I've been watching it a lot this week, especially because I watch Microsoft every day, and this week officials from that company started weighing in, which was interesting in itself because first Bill Gates made a few statements earlier in the week. He participated in a few interviews, and he seemed very iffy on his stance. In one interview, I remember he said that the FBI should have access to information on terrorism, like regardless of the means it needs to get it. And he also said Apple wouldn't really be creating a backdoor, that this is just a very specific scenario. And then after that, a whole bunch of publications are saying, oh, Bill Gates backs the FBI. And he went on another interview later and said, oh, that's not true. So very iffy stance. But then Microsoft actually came out yesterday, I think, and their chief legal officer said that they would be filing a motion with the court in support of Apple. And it'll be doing that in conjunction with Google, with Alphabet and with Facebook. And I think Twitter will be filing a motion in support of Apple as well. So it's been a really interesting week to watch it. You know, I'm fascinated.
I think fascinated describes the way that a lot of us are about this. Now, Dave, you're out there near Silicon Valley, and Kelly brought up the fact that a number of companies that we all know and are familiar with are filing motions in support of Apple. Have you heard of companies filing briefs in support of the government's position?
I have no doubt that there are companies that support the government's position. It would be a PR nightmare, however, to come out and actively support it in quite the way, like to actually file a motion in court to support such a thing would come off very poorly in Silicon Valley. However, one of the things that I think is going on here is that Tim Cook is trying to protect what he sees as a differentiator between Apple and Android. It is pretty much accepted that this would not be a problem if this phone were an Android phone. And Cook knows that. Cook knows that that's part of their strategic advantage. And a compromise that I think most people would be willing to live with is the one that they don't want because it eliminates the strategic advantage, which is somehow opening the phone under a warrant with that phone and doing it specifically based on them holding the key to opening it, not giving the government anything, but them being able to do it. They don't want to do that, not because of, in my opinion, not because of any ethical reasons, but simply because it is a strategic differentiator to say, even we can't open your phone. And personally, normally I'm on the side of privacy and security, but personally, I'm not comfortable with the idea that somebody, that a corporation that's only beholden to stockholders and is trying to say we can protect data and privacy better than a government, which is a frightening thing. When we're trying to decide who protects us better, our government or a corporation, we've already lost the fight. You know, that's a really scary position to be in. So I think that this comes down to coming up with a compromise to say, you know, we're not going to give you the ability to open every phone whenever you feel like it, but we've got to do this. Because if I were a safe company, I couldn't advertise to, you know, hey, drug lords and crime lords, here's a safe the government doesn't know how to open, and we won't open it under a warrant. You know, that's not an okay thing. We've established legally hundreds of years of precedent that when the government has a warrant, you're supposed to do something about it. So as much as I support privacy and as much as I support encryption, there has to be a compromise here, in my opinion. But the compromise means losing a piece of strategic business differentiation for Apple, and I don't think they want to do that.
Well, now here, and I want to at this point do a disclaimer for all of our listeners. To my knowledge, no one in the discussion on the air right now is an attorney, and
correct,
none of us are playing attorneys on the radio or anywhere else. So all of what you're hearing is the lay speculation of people whose job it is to make words happen, not to be lawyers.
Correct.
But I'd like to play devil's advocate a little bit and get, Dave, your take on this, and Kelly, yours as well. One of the key pieces of Apple's objection, they say, is that the government is not asking them to disable something. They're asking them to create a new piece of software. Basically, they're asking Apple to go back and write a new operating system, one that doesn't include key portions of the existing operating system. So if they succeed and Apple is compelled to create a new piece of software, is there a limit to the kind of software that a company could be compelled to create if the government said that it was important for security?
Well, the issue here for me is the matter of the warrant and the due process, right? So if the government said, Apple, you must create a piece of software that allows us to surveil without a warrant everyone who owns an iPhone, Apple should say no. If the government says we have a specific warrant in a specific case to get specific data from a specific phone, you must help us, I believe in a legal process. And under that circumstance, I believe Apple is compelled to cooperate. That doesn't mean that they then give that software to anybody else. It doesn't mean that they help anybody in any other way. But to me, it's all about a due legal process. If there is a warrant and a compelling legal reason for their assistance, they should follow through. And maybe that makes me a dupe of the government. I'm willing to say that. But I feel like at some point we have to trust some aspect of our legal process or we have to start over. We have to throw it all out, you know. So under that very tight and very specific term, I don't think there is a reason for Apple to say no. When it doesn't involve that very specific situation, Apple should always say no.
All right. Kelly, what's your take on all this?
I agree with the idea of needing to trust in a legal system and keeping everything in place, but I think that the compelling legal reason is kind of where it gets tricky. Like here in this specific situation, it's easy to say, oh, like we need this information from this specific phone for this very specific reason because, you know, the information on the phone could be dangerous or implicate other people who might have been involved in the attack. But I think that a lawyer or government official could get very like creative with like, oh, this is a compelling legal reason why we need information from like these 10 iPhones. You know, I feel like there's the potential for like a snowball effect. Like, where does that end?
Well, you know, I'm going to agree with you. And there's already a federal prosecutor who has agreed with you. I believe he's in New York and he has talked to the press and said that he's got a dozen iPhones that he has ready to file subpoenas on as soon as Apple is compelled to create this software.
There are also right now thousands of apartments that the government is about to enter with a warrant to find information. The ubiquity of the phone doesn't change the fact that you still need a judge to say this specific case warrants this action.
I agree that the judge is absolutely critical in this. And to me, one of the fascinating things, Dave, you pointed out the trust issue. If this had happened 36 months ago, I think we'd be having a very different set of discussions because after the revelations that came about through the Snowden release of information, the discussion about trust took a markedly different turn. And I think that's going to be true for a long time to come. And as I said last week, I also think that this is something where Apple is playing not just to an American audience, but to an international audience. Because as we know, we can trust in the U.S. government to whatever extent our philosophy allows us to do so. But there are other governments around the world that I think many of us would agree are less trustworthy than the U.S. government. And once the software has been shown to be possible, then I think all bets are off when it comes to these phones around the world. So it's a huge issue, and I think it's going to be fascinating to watch it play out over the coming weeks and months.
Right. Well, let me ask you one question, Kurt. We've seen plenty of people say that if Apple won't do it, they'll do it, right? So here's the question. Do you want Apple to do it under legal observation and hopefully Apple does it with care, or do you want someone else to do it? Because that's the real question. We know it's possible. We know with the right amount of money and the right amount of resources, this will happen. So I think the question comes down to, would you rather have Apple do it under a controlled setting, or would you rather somebody else do it? And that, to me, is the scarier option.
It is a scarier option. But this is one of those where there are, I think, legitimate both legal and philosophical arguments to be made. My personal sense tends to come down more on the side of protecting privacy at all costs. But I recognize that there are those who have a different opinion on that. And that's one of the reasons that we have things like the Supreme Court, because the people who put the nation together recognized we would hit points where there were these essential disagreements that needed to be resolved somehow. And I'm glad that we have a mechanism for doing so. I think I would be happier were that mechanism at full strength, but that's a political discussion for another show entirely. And speaking of other shows, I think we're going to have to push discussions of this and other issues to other shows because, doggone it, we've hit the end of our half hour here at Information Week Live. So before we all head off into the sunset, let's talk about what's coming up. Kelly, how about with you? What should people look for from you in the week or weeks to come?
I'm keeping an eye out for some Windows updates next week. I think there's some things rolling out, but on Information Week, and I'll be posting stuff on that, I think.
All right. And how can people follow you on the various social media? How can they find out what you're doing on a day-to-day basis at Information Week?
Twitter is my channel of choice. You can find me at Kelly Sheridan. That's KellySheridan22.
Outstanding. We will look forward to following you on Twitter and at Information Week. Dave, how about you? What is coming up in your part of the world in the week to come?
Well, I'll be playing Where in the World is Kelly Sheridan from now through next year as she goes globetrotting on her adventures. beyond that, on Monday, I am talking to the CIO of a major corporation. I don't know if I should say now who it is, who has just been appointed CIO. And we're going to talk about basically the first 100 days of being a first-time CIO. I think it's going to be really exciting to talk about that with a new CIO who's just started out. I think he's only been on the job for about 3 weeks now. Talk about his priorities, what he learned, what he's learning the hard way now. And I think it should be a lot of fun.
Outstanding. Well, we will look forward to that. And where can people follow you on social media?
At GeekNDave on Twitter. And you can also find me on Information Week and allanalytics.com.
Outstanding, Dave. Thank you so much for being with us today. Now,
oh, sure. Thank you, Kurt.
As for me, I've got a piece coming on. Dave mentioned a first-time CIO. I've got a piece coming out on a first-time CISO. And it's not just that it's her first time to be a CISO, but the organization that she is with, it's their first CISO as well. Now, this is not something about a beginner, because this is someone who is a former deputy CIO of the White House. So a great seasoned IT professional, first time in this particular position. I think it's a good story. That'll be coming up early in the week. I'm going to be continuing to follow information about DevOps and development, and getting ready to, in a week, head to Orlando for the Enterprise Connect conference. This is all about mobile communications. It's all about unified communications, enterprise communications, lots of stuff going on down there. I'll be reporting from that show in 2 weeks. You can follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. And before we go, I want to mention one thing. We're sitting here on February 26th. We have just a few days before the nominations close for Information Week's Women in IT Award. That will be awarded at the Information Week Elite 100 Conference in May. If you know a woman who has made a significant impact in her organization's IT department, if you know someone who has made a significant contribution to IT in general, this is your chance to have her be recognized. Go to informationweek.com. You'll find the link to nominate someone for the Information Week Elite 100 Conference's Women in IT Award. Those nominations are due on March 1st. So please go go look for those. Well, that's it for another episode of Information Week Live. We'll be back with you next Friday at the same time. Until then, for Kelly Sheridan, Dave Wagner, and all of us here at Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.